sunny Hawaii on a very, very rainy cleansing afternoon here on the big island of Hawaii in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. Welcome to Dolphinville Radio. This is your host, Dolphinus. And today we have an opportunity to listen to some words of wisdom from an excellent guest who I had an opportunity to spend some time with this last week, Peter Russell. Peter is a quite well-known international speaker and somebody who will provide us with some insights about consciousness and the idea of God and meditation, some of the things that he's been doing for many, many years. He's a fellow of the Institute of Noetic Sciences and the World Business Academy and the Finhorn Foundation, among other things, honorary member of the Club of Budapest. He was a student. As a student, he became interested in metaphysics and theoretic physics, as well as mathematics. Then he became increasingly fascinated by the mysteries of the human mind as he changed his major at University of Cambridge in England to experimental psychology. In fact, they created a special department just for Peter Russell at the time. Pursuing this interest, he traveled to India and for many years studied meditation and Eastern philosophy at the ashrams throughout India. It was on his return to the UK that he took up the first research post ever offered in Britain on the psychology of meditation. He also has a postgraduate degree in computer science and conducted there some of the early experiments, some of the early work on the three-dimensional displays, passages by some 20 years of advent of virtual reality, three-dimensional displays in computer science. His principal interest is a deeper spiritual significance of the times that we're passing through now. He's written a myriad of books, some of them which you may have heard of, The TM Technique, The Upanishads, A New Rendition and Translation, The Brain Book, The Global Brain Awakens, The Creative Manager, The Consciousness Revolution, Waking Up in Time, and From Science to God, his latest book. He gained honors degree in physics and experimental psychology from the University of Cambridge in England, and a postgraduate degree in computer science. And he's authored and lectured and explored the potentials of human consciousness, integrating the Eastern and Western facts, Eastern wisdom with Western science. And he's shared this with audiences much the same as some of his predecessors. And he's contributed these insights, the nature of consciousness and the global change, to audiences such as those at the Prophets Conference. He's one of the first to present personal development programs to the business community, and over the past 20 years, he's been a consultant for IBM, Apple, American Express, Barclays Bank, Swedish Telecom, Nike, Shell, British Petroleum, and other major corporations, bringing them spirituality on a new level. He didn't call it spirituality because they wouldn't listen then. Peter is a fascinating guy. I spent time with him at Joan Ocean's workshop where we swam with dolphins and whales for a week, and I was able to get him aside and conduct this interview. So I hope you'll be with us and listen to the wisdom of Peter Russell. And stay with us so we'll get this going. So Peter Russell, beginning there right now. Your role as somebody who is straddling the frontiers of science and metaphysics, I believe metaphysics, or let's say spirituality might be a better way of terming it, is somebody I think is fascinating and interesting to be able to contribute. So I, first of all, I'd just love to hear your take on what you feel your involvement with spirituality and how it's applying itself to science, spirituality, and what we're looking at today, and as your perception sees it.
Yeah, well, first of all, I suppose you have to say, what is spirituality? It's one of these words which is bandied around a lot today. Almost anything that, I sometimes find people thinking anything that's non-scientific or doesn't fit into the current scientific paradigm is spiritual. And I don't think that's what spirituality is at all. It isn't just about the unexplained or things. To me, spirituality is really about deep exploration into oneself, understanding oneself, and seeing what it is that limits us, what it is that holds us back from really being the full human beings we can be. And I think that's what all the spiritual traditions have done in one way or another, the world's great spiritual traditions. They've usually started from people or small groups of people who, through their own personal experience, have realized that the normal state of consciousness that we live in is a very limited, almost automatic, dreamlike state. And for one reason or another, they've broken out of that and woken up to a full experience of reality. And it's that waking up which I think is the essence of spirituality, that inner awakening to one's own deeper self, breaking free from the mindsets, belief systems that keep us trapped. And then they have each in their own ways tried to help others. The freedom they feel from that, the incredible sense of peace, the love that comes from that, the compassion they just feel is something that everybody should share. It's, I think when you have that experience, is that feeling, this is so natural, it's there within us all, it's so natural, it's so close, and yet we keep ourselves apart from it because we're looking in the other direction. We're not looking within. In our culture, we're looking outside the whole time, or almost the whole time. And so they taught various techniques, practices, meditation, prayer, some movements, breathing, whatever it is, they find that help us go within and let go of the various things we're holding on to that keep us so stuck. And then I think what's happened over time is, as those teachings have been passed on from one person to another, they've naturally, you're passing on from an awake person to a less awake person, to someone who's even less awake. And each time it's passed on in that way, something's going to be missed out, something's not going to be fully understood, something might be embellished or added in. So slowly, the teachings, it's what I sometimes call truth decay, they slowly lose their essence and they become ritualized, dogmatic. And that's when I think spirituality becomes a religion. It becomes a belief system rather than an effective practice to actually help induce those states of consciousness, those states of the liberated mind. So I see spirituality is basically about understanding how we get ourselves trapped away from that state of freedom that we're all yearning for, and the means to accomplish that.
Well, it's a seeking of knowledge of self, you might say.
Yeah.
I presume that you must have had an experience that started you out in that path. Can you describe what it was that was the epiphanal event in your life?
I didn't, actually. Funnily enough, a lot of people ask that. It was like always there in some way or another, and it gradually just got stronger. I remember as a kid I was sort of interested in the mind. I was most interested in science, mathematics, physics. That was my background. But all along I had this interest in the mind, and I was reading about yogis doing strange things when I was a teenager and playing around with things that would alter my states of consciousness. I was building little machines that would, you know, flick light. I controlled the rate of flickering lights in my brain, that sort of stuff, and playing around with things and looking at self-hypnosis. So I was always exploring the mind. And then I wasn't interested in religion though, or spirituality. I was interested in the mind and human consciousness. And at that stage I was interested in dolphins and whales too and their consciousness. And then through the 60s, I, like many people, I had experiences with psychedelics, and that showed me that there were other ways of experiencing the world that opened me up to the fact that we didn't have to be stuck in this particular way of experiencing reality. But also, I think, like many people, I realized that that wasn't really going to be an effective path. It could give you glimpses of something, and I think in hindsight a lot of the glimpses were pretty weird, but you know, they weren't really on track of the spiritual. But sometimes one had that opening, that loss of ego, and that opening to something greater, and that sense of peace. And like many people, I realized this is something that could be done naturally, and many of the great yogis, saints, those sorts of people had found out how to do this naturally. So that's what started me off looking at spiritual practices. And I started meditating, and then I went out to India, drove out to India, and lived in India for a while, living in various ashrams and studying with various teachers. And I think two things happened then. One, was a realization of what I just said, that underneath all the great spiritual teachings was this common essence, which was basically a psychological aspect. It wasn't about God or divinity. I mean, we think religion is about, you know, God Almighty, but of course that's just the Judeo-Christian and Islamic version of religion. You get the Buddhist religion where there's no God at all. In Confucianism there isn't really a God. In Taoism there isn't a God. In Hinduism there isn't a single God. There's various deities, but they're more reflections of aspects of the way reality works. So I began to see that the common element of religion was not about God. The common element was an understanding of human psychology and how we get trapped in this materialist approach and how to break free of that. And what's happened in our culture is that's been conceptualized in terms of our Judeo-Christian culture, mm-hmm. and that sort of religion. And the second thing I realized was that this was essential to the world today. If I looked around what was happening in the world, whether it was, you know, big global environmental issues or social issues or even personal issues in my own life, almost everything came back to human consciousness, usually as the root cause, or else as the reason we weren't able to solve it. We were stuck in certain ways of thinking, and it's our egocentricity, our fear-based thinking, wanting to be in control, wanting to maintain our sense of identity or power or whatever it is, or role in society, how people see us. This was what was lying behind all our problems. And yet what we do when we're faced with a problem is we try and tackle what's happening out there. We try and tackle the, you know, destruction of the rainforest, for example, which we should be tackling, but we don't at the same time say, what is it in human consciousness that allows us to do this? Because we know that a lot of what we're doing is insane, that if we continue doing this, we're going to destroy our own habitat. And yet we continue doing it. And nobody asks that question of what is it that's wrong with us. We can see what's wrong with the consequences of our actions, but just trying to keep on correcting the consequences doesn't deal with the root problem. What is it in our thinking? And that's where I saw that the wisdom that the world spiritual traditions had come up with and discovered time and time again, that same basic wisdom, was really needed in the world today. And so I came back from India, and my mission really has been since then, in one way or another, to distill what I consider to be the essence of the world's spiritual traditions, and then find ways to encapsulate that in language, examples, forms that can be digested by the ordinary, everyday person. And I spent 15 years just teaching in corporations, just taking these ideas that I found fascinating and running seminars in corporations to people who'd run a mile at anything spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
But the challenge I enjoyed was how to take these ideas and put them in ordinary, everyday, almost prosaic terms so that they could get it. Because I think anything that's valid is valid in itself. It doesn't depend upon the language.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I got into it, and I've moved through. I don't do much corporate work anymore. I then got involved in environmental issues, and now come back. My life much more these days is more just teaching meditation, coming back to just helping people, giving them practical techniques to actually experience this for themselves.
Hmm. Well, when we talked earlier, you reminded me, or at least I thought of you as a modern day Alan Watts. Somebody who, a British background, but was kind of assimilating the Eastern traditions and bringing them to the Western culture. Of course, during his period of time, the 50s and 60s, it was almost unheard of, and he happened to come in at the same time as the psychedelics. And there was a lot of parallels between what people were experiencing in the psychedelic experience, and they were finding some kind of groundwork in what he was explaining were the Eastern doctrines. So, in a way, you're like a modern-day Alan Watts, and here you are living in Sausalito like Alan Watts.
Only 200 yards from Alan Watts' boat.
Yeah.
On a boat close to his old boat.
So you think there's some reincarnated energies that are recirculating there?
I don't know about reincarnated, but I think we're tuned into the same whatever it is, mission. I think we're on the same track. I mean, he, as you say, he was doing the same thing of taking the Eastern teachings and making them understandable in a Western context, and he was a great hero of mine. I mean, he influenced me a lot with his books, and In fact, the very first time I came to the US in 1973, it was almost on a pilgrimage to Sausalito. I was coming to California, but I made sure I went to Sausalito. I wanted to go there. It's like Alan Watts, Sausalito, and here I am 30 years later living there.
Yes, yes, and carrying on the tradition, I might add, because I think it's so important what you've contributed with your book, for example, The Global Mind, The Global Consciousness, and how the we're elevating ourselves to be thinking of ourselves in planetary terms. This is so important right now. And it is a melding of the East and West that is allowing that to happen. Have you found that more and more people are becoming interested in this type of subject, this type of dealing, looking at us as a collective consciousness?
Yes, yes, I think this is growing throughout the world, throughout our culture. And I think for several reasons. Firstly, I think people are realizing that the old individualistic, self-centered mode of consciousness isn't working anymore. Well, it's working in some ways, but it has its limitations. Clearly, as I say, you know, most of the problems that are happening in the environment come down to that egocentric mode of functioning or some aspect of it. And it's clear if we continue like this, we're going to destroy the environment. So there's something up there that isn't working. It doesn't really work for us as individuals. We're not any happier. In fact, studies that have been done show that people today are no happier than they were 40 years ago. Despite the fact, you know, today we have so many more luxuries, facilities, opportunities, amenities, you know, better cars, comforts, all that stuff.
Hmm. The fear factor has gone up, though.
Hmm?
The fear factor
has
gone up.
Probably, yes. Well, there's a lot of fear around then. We had fear of nuclear war and things. But it's just, I think we're learning that having all that stuff, the toys, the comforts, doesn't actually nourish us inside.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, people are beginning to look for something else. And I think there's an awareness that we are living in a global culture. And that was started, I think, by the moonshots and those pictures the astronauts took on their way back to mm-hmm. the whole Earth, which mm-hmm. we'd never seen before.
Mm-hmm.
And that picture, I think, was one of the most important pictures ever to be taken, and definitely the most important spin-off from the trip to the moon. It was not the dust they brought back,
right,
the pictures
right.
they brought back.
Mm-hmm.
And they're still used everywhere because they capture that spirit of we are a global community
mm-hmm.
living on one planet, and our destiny is now a common destiny. We're not just tribes, and what one tribe does affects what the other tribes do. So that concern for the planet as a whole has been growing, and now with the internet, with just more and more media, television, things, we continue becoming more and more aware of our collective aspect, that we are a single global community, and the fact that we need to actually get our stuff together if we're going to get through this.
One of the ways that it occurred to me as a way of expressing it is that we've placed so much importance on the land masses, the solid aspects of the planet throughout our culture and our history, and when actually we're a water planet, we're water beings on a water planet, and yet we've solidified our thinking and our emotions. And perhaps this new movement is helping us to let go of that thinking, and actually liquefy our consciousness, become like liquid and the water element that we actually are. And I see when people start to let go in the water, for example, and how they relax into it and become naturally buoyant, the same thing occurs for pure consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
People often struggle in this vast sea of unknown, when in fact we're naturally buoyant in that, as our spirituality mm-hmm. would dictate.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting, I think what's really conditioned human consciousness and made it tighten up, and I think this is what has happened to our consciousness, it's got tight, and when you go into deep meditation you can really feel this, there's a tightening in human consciousness, and when we let go, there's just this loosening that happens in the consciousness. And I think you're right, because we live on the earth, the earth rather than the water, the land, and because we have thumbs, we become this very manipulative species. We take the earth and we reshape it into all these forms. We create all these different materials out of the earth and we build things with it and we create gadgets and technologies with it. And so our whole consciousness has become focused on what we can do and what we can have. And it's all about this manipulating, controlling, influencing and possessing this firm material world, including other people. We get into controlling, manipulating, possessing other people as well, because we have this belief that if I can just get the world around me to be right and other people to be the way I want them to be, I'll be happy. Now, when you go into water, you don't have that ability. And it's interesting, if you look at all the mammals that have gone back into water, the whales, the dolphins, the seals, the sea lions, the walruses, all of them, they've lost their thumbs, they've lost their hands. They don't need hands anymore. The hands have just become flippers. What they need is just a way to stabilize and move in the water. But they don't have thumbs anymore. They've lost them. They've lost their hands. Because you can't manipulate water. You can't reshape water. You can't build things out of water. And you know, the cetaceans, they haven't built underwater freeways or whatever. They haven't done all that. They don't need to.
It's one big freeway.
Yeah. But you can't manipulate water, and so your consciousness hasn't been trapped in that controlling, manipulative mode. And that, I think, is what a lot of the great spiritual teachings have seen, that that's what gets us caught. And what the Buddha saw was that suffering, and in fact the word suffering isn't quite the right translation. The Pali word is dukkha, which is the opposite of sukha. And sukha means ease, to be at ease. And so dukkha, which was translated by Victorians as suffering when they first came across Buddhism, actually means discomfort, to be ill at ease, to be dis-ease, not
stressed.
Yes, stress basically. Mm-hmm. Discomfort. You're not at peace. You're not at ease. And what the Buddha saw is we are not at ease because of wanting. We want things to be different. We either don't accept things as they are, we don't accept the present as it is, we want it to be different. We want things in the future to be different, or we want the past to be different. But we don't actually accept what is, and it's this wanting that actually tightens up the mind. That continual wanting is what creates that inner mental stress.
Mm-hmm.
And that is because I think that comes out of the fact that we have this ability to control the world and change it. We aren't living in this fluid world, we're living in this very fixed material world, and so we get caught in this thing that we can change it or resist this change. So that's where the wanting comes in. Well, I think if you're living in a fluid medium like water, you don't want, because there's no point in craving, wanting, desiring. You're just much more in accepting what is.
Mm-hmm. Well, which brings us to the dolphins and the whales, having chosen to enter back into the ocean by whatever counts, but several million years ago. And you must assume that since they have the capacity for mental processing, they have evolved tools with their minds to actually manipulate their environment in a biological way,
mm-hmm.
and yet they don't have the material wanting and desire constructs that humans have.
Mm-hmm.
How do you explain now the phenomenon, since Dr. Lilly started his study as a scientist and then pulled out of his scientific studies back in the 50s and 60s, to start to really draw parallels between what he was perceiving from the dolphin experience and some of the great Eastern and Western teachings in spirituality?
Mm-hmm.
You said you had an early interest. Have you been able to parallel those kinds of things along the way?
The way I see it is that it comes back to what we were just saying, that I think the state of consciousness that dolphins are in, and one has to say this carefully because it's very easy to project onto another creature. I don't even know what state of consciousness you're in, and you're another fellow human being. You know, I can make guesses by, you know, how you look at things. With another species, it's much, much harder to start projecting. However, having said that, my experience with dolphins suggests, I get the feeling they are at peace. They seem to be loving, what we would call loving, compassionate, caring. They have that playfulness they seem to just move with the flow. There's not that sense of hustle or anxiety with them. In a way, I think they are the reflection of what we would like to be. I think that's why we have this deep fascination with them, because they touch this deep yearning in ourselves for that deep inner freedom. And I think everything we see in the dolphin, in fact yesterday in the workshop, you weren't, or were you there, was it the day before, when I was going around saying, what is it that touches you about the dolphin experience? And everybody had their own thing they came up with, what touched them. And then we looked at them, and as someone said afterwards, every single one of these things is a quality of what we would say is enlightenment. So I think we see in them a symbol of that state of enlightenment. I prefer to use the word freedom, just that inner mental conscious freedom that comes from just waking up to one's own nature that we all would love. And so many people are trying to get through one way or another, going off to yoga classes and meditation, joining spiritual groups, because we're seeking that. We don't quite know what it is, but we know there's something there that we're seeking. And dolphins are a reflection of that in some ways. So I think, coming back to what you said, I think what the Eastern teachings are pointing towards for human beings, the dolphins are a living reflection of. And that's why we love them.
We've called them angels of the sea, maybe because they do reflect this sublime understanding of their own selves and their environment. They're totally integrated with what they're doing. They have what seems to be a state of peace. And we have, when we do enter into their environment, because for years when they were just on display as clown acts in the water park shows, that helped us to appreciate them for their grace and power, and somewhat their intelligence, because we could recognize they could perform certain tricks and tasks at on command. But really that changed when people started to enter the water. And I think there's a significant combination of things that are going on. First of all, we're entering into another atmosphere. Secondly, we're going into an environment which is their home. They're not in our, we're not going to a containment or a captive facility. Instead, we're entering into the vast unknown, which is their backyard. So I think that has a profound implication before anything is said and done. But then we're experiencing the very nature of these beings. The water itself is a conductant. We know that energy is moving throughout. We can actually measure vibrational frequencies, mental and emotional vibrational frequencies. We can measure those. So we know that the water is doing something. It's our impression, those of us who've been with dolphins, that there is a subtle communication or an exchange of information going on these very subtle, almost non-linear realms. And you had some experiences that seemed to, first of all, it was a captive facility that had your first kind of like really astounding dolphin facility. How has your attitude or your informational stream changed since that first encounter? Maybe you can start with that encounter and take us through it.
Yes, well, in fact, to go back even further, I've always been fascinated by whales. Even when I was a kid, I was reading all the books I could find on them, and it was there in the background, it was always there. And my first opportunity was in Bermuda, and that I was in my early 20s then. And that was in, there's a research, marine research, to the university facility. And that fortunately these weren't ones that were captive in, you know, concrete pool, that horrible thing. It was actually a cordoned off area of a bay. So they were in seawater, and there was a large net across the bay. So they were still, they couldn't go and roam the ocean, but at least I thought it was a bit better than being in a little concrete tank.
And sort of connected to the ocean as well.
Yes, they couldn't go very far. They probably had a couple of hundred yards to roam, but you know, as we know, dolphins love miles and miles. That experience, even that just blew me away, as I think everybody's first experience with another creature of similar intelligence does, and just that the way they cared for me, the way I sensed they felt my apprehension. And I'm vulnerable in water, and I was thinking, these are big creatures, these were bottlenose dolphins, they're big creatures, and they could easily, you know, one accidental hit of their flukes on me and I could be knocked unconscious and I could drown there. I was, you know, it was a, I was very vulnerable, and they seemed to sense that and just only approach so far, and as I softened and relaxed, they got closer and closer. And just that eye contact was really important. I knew from then on that I had this, my own personal dolphin connection mission. So I just made it a point in my life after that to be with dolphins in the wild whenever they show themselves. And that has just been random times in my life. Living in England, what happens from time to time is lone dolphins, for one reason or another, get separated from their pod. No one quite understands why, there's lots of guesses, but they end up on their own around the coast, and they tend then to hang around usually fishing ports, little harbours, and you find that they're usually noticed because they're sort of riding the bow wave of the fishing boats, and a fisherman notices there's this lone dolphin, and then people go out and swim with it. And I,
was it Fungi?
The first one I was with was one called Simo, which was off Wales, and that was probably just a juvenile, probably only about a year old or something, don't know what it was, and he was around for a couple of years and then disappeared. That was my first experience, but a lot with him, and then with Fungi, just going back, spending a lot of time with him, that's in Ireland, and then with another one that appeared further down south in Ireland, and just he appeared just and grabbed my wetsuit and went off and jumped in, and just, and what I loved then was something about the incredible playfulness of the bottlenose, and particularly these lone ones, so they're not in a pod, they've got nothing else to do, their focus is on you, and just, it just became one huge dance, and just interaction, and allowing to let the dolphin lead the dance, and sometimes it was like three-dimensional dancing in water, whatever it was, and sometimes it was just that swimming, that eye-to-eye contact. And what I found fascinating, one of my first learnings was that I could have eye-to-eye contact with a dolphin, but if my mind wasn't in contact, it went off. I could be swimming eye-to-eye, and as soon as my mind started chattering and saying, isn't this wonderful, I'm having eye-to-eye contact with a dolphin, I swear my eye hadn't moved, but my mind had, and before I knew what the dolphin had turned, it disappeared. It's like, okay, if you're not going to be with me, I'm not going to bother to be with you.
So that would be a case for telepathy or telempathy?
Something like, yes, something like that. I don't know how to put words on it, because it's just, it was an experience I had which suggests there's some sort of something going on.
Well, as a man of science, somebody who's put a lot of time and energy into physics and the hard sciences, how do you feel about some of the paranormal or parapsychological things that people are experiencing, not only with dolphins, but with themselves, such things as remote viewing, for example?
Yeah. I think the evidence for this, taken as a whole, is very convincing. As a whole, you take any individual experiment, you can pick holes in it, but when you do what is called meta-analysis, where you analyze the data from lots of different experiments, and there's statistical ways of doing that, you end up with basically overwhelming evidence for this happening. And most people have had these experiences in their life. I've had various experiences of this nature, and I saw a study the other day that says like 60-70% of the population feel they've had these experiences at one time or another. The problem is that what you're dealing with here is something that goes right against, or it's right outside the current scientific paradigm. The current scientific paradigm says these things can't occur. These things don't occur. That mind is just something that emerges from the brain, and there's no physical way that one mind could influence another, and because we can't see any physical way, therefore it can't happen. And so the scientific establishment still doesn't take seriously the results, because they believe their belief is so strong that this cannot happen. They believe, therefore, it's much more likely that the meta-analysis is wrong, that the experiments, for them it's more believable that hundreds of experiments are all, for one reason or another, flawed, than the fact that maybe there's something that goes against the paradigm. And this is just, it's a sad thing in science, but it's part of science that, in fact, it was the quantum physicist Max Planck who said science changes not because scientists change their mind, but because the old scientists die out, the views die out with the scientists. So what we're seeing here is a clash of paradigms, and There's a very interesting article in the Science magazine New Scientist just a couple of weeks ago on this, looking at, it was actually a mathematical model of belief and how our beliefs get reinforced. And the conclusion was that if you come with the belief that these things are impossible, then basically no amount of evidence is going to convince you. And it was, and I think the people in the, who are doing all the work on psychic experiments, on healing and the paranormal, who are gathering all this scientific data, think that if they can just gather enough data and really do the ultimate experiment that proves it, then they'll convert everybody. And what this article was saying was, basically that's never going to happen. You can gather the most incredible data, but it will never change a person's belief system. They'll find some way not to look at it. It's like the bishops with Galileo, when he said, you know, look down my telescope, they said, what's the point? We know what you're saying is impossible. What's the point?
I won't believe what I see anyway.
Yeah, there's no point looking down your telescope. You know, something's happening there that's weird, but, you know, I know what I know.
Mm-hmm.
So, until the paradigm itself shifts, I don't think people will change their minds.
Mm. Well, it occurred to me one time, and, you know, getting back to the dolphins, when I had some experience with the dolphins throughout my life, but one of the most profound things that happened to me was when I was in my 40s and I had my first opportunity to consciously go in the water with free-swimming dolphins, and it was bottlenose dolphins in Key West. And I can honestly say that I really feel as if something occurred, something maybe was either intentionally or unintentionally manipulated with inside of me, where I felt as if I had an IQ boost because I was able to either relax into or for the first time conceptually begin to deal with things like quantum physics, which I had a kind of a cursory passing interest, but it seemed like for the first time some things clicked together, as if that experience itself opened up other areas. Perhaps my own belief system or what have you. But I'm just wondering if there is any correlation between that experience, the physical reality of actually going in with dolphins and whales, that would have a profound mental effect on consciousness of humans.
I really don't know. I mean, I think these things happen. I have no idea of how to explain it.
Mm-hmm.
And almost, I think it's sometimes wrong to try and think of it as cause effect.
Mm-hmm.
I think the more important thing is this happens.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, I think if we try to explain it as how does this happen, we may be making the mistake, almost falling back into a materialist way of thinking, which is a sort of cause and effect model.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I like about Jung's notion of synchronicity.
Mm-hmm.
That these things happen, and his definition of synchronicity was it was an acausal connecting principle, acausal meaning without cause.
Mm-hmm.
That it was, there were coincidences, what was happening in one person's consciousness was related to what was happening in another person, or related to what was happening in the world. But he was saying maybe it's a mistake to think that what is happening in the world, whether it's the interaction with the dolphin, the being underwater, the opening of your own experience, a mistake may be to use the word effect, that was an effect of it, but there's something that happens in those situations.
Mm.
And the important thing, I think, is to really honour, respect, to value that shift, and to know that happened.
Well, synchronicity is a word that's often associated not only with Carl Jung, but I've heard it used when people feel that they are involved with several synchronistic events, that their spiritual path has been enlivened.
Yeah.
And that's one of the clues that they look for. If, some people use time, for example, 333 or 444 or 111, looking at a license plate, somebody was doing an exercise where they're actually asking to see three numbers in a row in a license plate while they're driving down the freeway, and then it will show up, as if there is some kind of rapport that they have with the world around them, and that's how they can prove it. So synchronicity may be a signpost.
Yes, and also the other way round as well. There's what I found fascinating when I was in India, and that in Indian teachings, one of the signs of how well you are doing in your spiritual progress is how much synchronicity there is in your life. So as well as it being a pointer towards something spiritual, it can also be a reflection of your own awakening. And I remember one teacher I was with, all he ever asked about my meditation was, are you noticing, he didn't use the word synchronicity, he talked about support of nature, the universe supporting you. He said, are you noticing more of that? That's all he wasn't interested in whether I was seeing angels or white lights or my breath stopping. Was I noticing more of this in my life? And since then, I've thought about it a lot, this, and what I've noticed is the more centered I am, the more still, the more in touch with myself I am, the more synchronicity happens. If I come off a meditation retreat, sometimes it's ridiculous. It's just I can't go anywhere without magic happening left, right and center. If I'm stressed, frazzled, forget it. Synchronicity isn't around. So it's a reflection of my inner state. And I think one of the reasons, as I now understand that for myself, just looking at various synchronistic things that have happened in my life, is that the synchronicities are out there waiting to happen all around us. All around us. You know, we could just walk past somebody an hour ago and there could have been an amazing synchronicity there, but we didn't stop to talk or something, we didn't pick it up. And I think the more clear I am inside, then the more intuitive I can be, the more I can open to the possibilities that are there, and maybe just find myself being led to a situation where a synchronicity is waiting to happen. So I think it's something like that that happens.
Well, almost a confirmation of our interconnectivity.
Yeah.
So when you are in a state of expanded awareness, and you have a sense of yourself in the universe, and the universe is there to agree with you. So it's you have to go to one before the other will acknowledge itself. And there again, getting back to going into the water with dolphins, you have silenced the world by putting your head in the water. You've silenced yourself by putting a snorkel in your mouth. These are two very important things to get you start to, you start to hear your breath through the tube, and all of these meditation techniques that one would hope for are a natural byproduct of just being in the water with the dolphins. And then you're getting smacked by the experience itself, which is exhilarating to say the least.
And what I find is after being with dolphins, my mind is silenced. My mind isn't chattering away. I've got a much more quiet mind. That normal blah 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 chattering to myself has gone.
Now someone I don't know whether it's been measured, the Monroe Institute, for example, did experiments using sound to replicate what the yogis have tried to do with themselves in meditation, which is to synchronize both hemispheres of the brain. Now, Joan, I think, pointed out that some studies indicated that being in the presence of dolphins and their resonant frequencies does the same thing. Have you experienced anything like that, and what can you tell us about
that? I haven't experienced that myself, and I don't know of any studies on the brain in that situation, so I can't really say on that.
But you have spent time at the Monroe Institute.
I have, yes.
Maybe you can tell us a little bit about that experience.
Yes, the Monroe Institute came from Bob Monroe, who... 30 years ago, maybe more now, started having out-of-the-body experiences, and he was looking for ways to facilitate that. He wanted to explore that more, and he started off using sensory deprivation, i.e. you go into a dark room and you float in water or whatever, so you just remove all sensory stimulation. And then he realized certain brainwave states were more likely to induce it, and so he developed a way called, it's now called hollow hemisync, hemisync, where you play slightly different tones to one ear and to the other, to the two ears, through headphones. It really works through headphones best. And what you get is, if you play, say, a tone of 100 cycles through the right ear, and you play a tone of 108 cycles through the left ear, you will get what's called a beat. You get an 8-cycle beat. And that beat isn't a sound beat, it's a beat between the two ears, so it's a beat in the neurophysiology of the brain. And so you don't hear the beat, and it's too low frequency to be heard anyway, but it forces the brainwave patterns into a rhythm of 8 cycles a second.
Like a wavering, as I recall.
Yeah. And so you can, by controlling the frequencies, you can control the brainwave patterns. And he found this really useful for inducing out-of-the-body experiences, sort of separating the conscious from the body, freeing it up. And he then charted a whole series of different levels and different realms that he went to. And basically that's what the process they do at the Munro Institute. Now, Bob passed away about 5-6 years ago, but his work goes on, and people go there and work with the different frequencies on different programs.
Well, I'm quite fascinated with his 27 realms of the, and many of those in the non-physical realities. And I think a lot of people who get involved, you know, or interested in spiritual practices naturally start to get involved with such things as out-of-body experiences and lucid dreaming and a whole plethora of things that would indicate that there is activity beyond the physical. And yet the physical is the realm of the hard science.
Mm-hmm.
And as you say, there is the hard science realm in waking reality, and then there is the mystical realm of, shall we say, the dreamtime reality. Mm-hmm. But there's indications that those things are being bridged. And I would say that your work is characteristic of the type of information that bridges those two disciplines.
Yeah, I think so. And it's interesting you mentioned lucid dreaming, because I think one way of looking at the whole waking up of human consciousness is to think of it as lucid waking.
I like that.
And it's more than just a nice phrase, because if you look at what happens in lucid dreaming, most of the time in dreaming, we don't know we're dreaming. We're caught up in the dream, and we're sweating or laughing, engrossed in the conversation or running from something. We don't know it's a dream. We think it's absolutely real. We're caught in it. And then you wake up and you realize, oh my God, that was just a dream, and all that fear was totally unnecessary. And then you have lucid dreaming, whereby people can be aware that I'm dreaming, and the dream continues, but you notice, you know you're dreaming, you know this is only a dream, and the dream still unfolds, and you watch it unfold, and you realize you can begin to influence it and direct it. So you're, in a sense, standing back from the dream and observing it. And I think that's what the spiritual awakening is about in daily life. We're also in a dream most of the time. We are so caught up in what is happening and the stories we tell ourselves, and worrying about, am I creating the right impression on so and so, or what's going to happen, and I must do this and do that, and oh, it's time to watch the news on television. And we live our lives in this unconscious state. We're living it, and we get caught up in our fears and our joys and our loves and all the running around. And I think that moment of awakening is the bit that suddenly wakes up and says, oh, I'm just, here I am, functioning on automatic, my mind chattering to myself and doing all this stuff. I thought I was awake, but I wasn't. I was just a robot. And there's this bit that stands back, and that's what we often call the higher self or the witness self, just stands back and just smiles at all this game going on. And that's what I call lucid waking, just being able to stand back and just witness it all, and just smile at oneself and one's ego mind for getting so caught up in all this stuff, and realizing that most of the stuff you fear is ridiculous anyway. We get caught up in all this fear, this tension that run our life.
Well, part of the process that you're encouraging in people with meditations and recognizing some of the Eastern practices and master practices is this self-awakening, the knowledge of self, which enables us to become lucid wakefulness. I think that's it's a great service that people really need at this time. There's something related to dreaming that comes to mind. A song line from the Enigma album of about 8 years ago that goes, remember what the shaman said, man is the dream of the dolphin, which brings it all kind of into another perspective. If the dolphins are conscious beings, they are conscious breathers, we know that, and that's one of the distinguishing things that we've illustrated many times to our people. We are unconscious breathers, and therefore we have a tendency to fall into these unconscious states, even waking or sleeping.
Yeah.
And so perhaps the breath is a key to waking ourselves up.
Yep. We look at many spiritual practices. They A lot of them just have meditation, just awareness of the breath, not to control it consciously and stop breathing, not that conscious control of the breath, but conscious awareness of the breathing just brings you back into the present moment, because the breath is always in the present moment, the experience of the breath. And so I think that's why many practices use the breath in one way or another, just awareness of it. So it's not, you're not breathing consciously, but you're conscious of your breathing in a way that we're not normally conscious of.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the same applies to be conscious of anything. Most of the time we're not conscious of what's happening, we're not conscious of what's going on in our bodies. You know, we sit here, but we're not really conscious of the sense of the pressure against the chair, or the air against the skin, or where there's discomforts, or whatever. We're not aware of that. And one exercise I often do with people is just, I just call it a curiosity exercise, just to be quiet and just be curious and to notice something in your body you haven't noticed before. And it's fascinating. Usually within a minute or two, someone says, "Oh my God, I just realised that goes on. I never noticed it before." And it's just because we've never stopped to notice. We're so busy in this doing, got to get this done, in this automatic robot-like mode, we don't stop just to be aware. And to me, that's what awareness is really about. What it should be about is just awareness of our sensory world. And we've got so caught up in thinking about the world, trying to control the world, that very seldom do we actually, we have to have techniques to get us back to being aware of it. So in some senses I think dolphin consciousness is how human beings were, or how human beings are, before we get screwed up, before we, you know, muddle the mind with all this worry thinking stuff.
Often before we're 8 years old, you mean?
Yeah. And before, in the present moment, if I could just stop this now, let go of all of that stuff, then I the state of consciousness I return to is where the dolphin's at. I also think it's where the dog is at, where the cow is at, the cat is at, and the shark is at. I think most creatures are living in this state of consciousness. When you get to a certain degree of complexity, I think what comes is the awareness that you are aware. Again, you know, recognizing the value, the danger of projection, I don't think a dog is self-aware. I suspect a dog isn't self-aware. I'm clear that a dog is conscious. It is aware. It seems to dream at night. You know, we know, you know, if we didn't believe dogs were conscious, we wouldn't make them unconscious with anesthetics when we operated on them. A dog is a conscious experiencing being, but I suspect a dog isn't conscious of being conscious like we are. And so it doesn't think of itself as an individual I and all that stuff. It is just experiencing. And it is in its experience, and that's why, you know, when a dog's got nothing to do, it doesn't get bored and start complaining. It'll just lie down and just put its chin on the ground and watch. When something happens, alerts its attention, it'll go and sniff it out. Another dog comes along, it'll start playing. Dolphins, though, being much more evolved in terms of their brain structure, larger brain, etc., I think are a similar level of consciousness to us. So I suspect that dolphins have some self-reflective consciousness, that they are conscious that they are conscious, so they're on a similar level to us, I suspect.
Well, now Joan talks about having experience of actually shape-shifting with dolphins, that is to say, kind of trading off, so that she would have the sensation of what it's like to be inside the dolphin while the dolphin is doing that to her. Now this has been reported by a number of traditions. Being able to shape-shift into an animal form has been very much a part of the Indian and indigenous peoples. Have you had any experiences of that, and what do you feel about that?
I haven't had experiences of that, not as a strong experience. I've sometimes had sort of intimations of it, but not as an experience. I accept that as possible. That's all I can say.
Well, a good friend of mine was able to study with the Aboriginals, for example, and she would do what is traditionally in some of the ceremonies, the Aboriginals, they would be able to assume the persona of an animal. And I didn't know the details of this, but I was astounded when she was performing with a number of them in a ceremony, and her task was to be a wallaby, which is a small kangaroo. And you know, I watched her prance around, and at one moment
I was startled because I knew who she was, and I knew her as a regular person. I actually saw her as a wallaby, and it just stopped my world entirely to recognize that she had found a technique through this study mm-hmm. to actually project wallabiness mm-hmm. to me, who knew her as something other than just a performer on stage. Well, this happened not only with her, but another friend of mine was able to project an owl on me in a similar way. So there seems to be something more than just a mental construct going on here. They're dabbling into another shimra, another realm, a dimensional aspect of being, which portends of something greater than physical, and that we're connected with the dolphins. And it always occurred to me that the dolphins had all of this spare time. They had their food taken care of, and they have all this play time that we see. But then they go into these deep meditations. It's not actually sleep. Certainly it's not unconscious sleep as we know. One wonders, well, where do they venture into their meditations?
Right. Yes.
And Joan and others speculate that they're actually quite good at going into other dimensional realms mm-hmm. and maybe having conversations across the universe. Any speculation on that?
I could speculate. I don't know. Anything is possible. Who knows? That's mm-hmm. all I can say. I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, I think that stuff is possible. Who knows? Mm-hmm. Who knows? We know so little about consciousness. We're just beginning to wake up to consciousness and its potentials. We've been so caught up in this materialistic worldview. We know hardly anything about the brain, for a start. I think, we'll look back on our understanding in 100 or 200 years' time and realize, how stuck we were in our understanding from this materialistic mode. So, who knows what, maybe everything we think is possible and a whole lot more is possible. We just have no idea. But I suppose I'm not really one to speculate, because it is just speculation, and I think it's probably still part of my strong scientific upbringing, years as a scientist. My approach to life is, first of all, is it my own experience? That's a crucial bit for me. If it isn't my own experience, does it fit in with my general understanding of the world? And I still feel that there's an incredible amount of value in the scientific worldview. It's just, it's not complete. It's not complete. So, I'm a skeptic at heart in the healthy sense, which is, I have an awful lot of things on hold. My jury is out on them. I hear interesting stuff, interesting evidence. I don't know what it signifies. I just don't know.
Well, one can rely on the experiential realm. And I've had experiences, and you've certainly had your experiences. Would you say that this is your second year of coming back and having a week-long seminar with people exposing themselves on a daily basis, going out on boats, getting in the water with dolphins? Can you say something about that to the listeners that would, sort of either clue them in on what your reflections of that experience, what the experiences that you've seen in others going through, that might be interesting?
My experience, I think, falls into two general categories. One, the actual experience of being with them is, everything else just fades into insignificance. It's this, I don't know what the word is quite, it's joy, but it's something transcendental almost, of being with another intelligent, conscious creature that is being with you in its own way, willingly, in a very gentle way, and acknowledging you. There's this deep sense of awe, and something about acceptance and recognition. I mean, the parallel that comes, it's not really a good parallel, but it's almost like there's somebody you really wanted to meet, either because you're very attracted to them, or they're a very famous person, or something, you really wanted to meet this person, and you you end up in an elevator with them and they turn around and engage you in this wonderful conversation, you feel, my God, they spoke to me. It's that sort of feeling. It's like, here I am in the water and the dolphin acknowledged me and interacted with me. It's like, wow, but it's more than that. There's something magic. It's just that sense of connection. So that's one thing, hard to put in words. The other thing, which is probably easier to put in words, is afterwards, I feel this lightness in my being. I just feel more alive, but not alive in an energetic way, but more just light and awake and alert inside and easier. As I said, I find my mind isn't thinking so much. My mind is much quieter. I'm at home in myself, and I'm very free. Like the last time I was here, I left here, and I had to go and give two lectures in Maui the next day. Two lectures, which is a lot normally. And I always sort of prepare my lectures to some extent. Every lecture is different. I never give the same lecture twice. So I always think beforehand what I'm going to say. And the night before, when I left here on the plane, I sort of sketched down some ideas. I thought I knew what I was going to say. I stood up there at one of those times where I just didn't bother about my notes or anything. I just spoke from my heart, and it just all came out what I wanted to say. And I just felt, I noticed for myself how unusual, I sort of get that, but how totally unusual and easy and self-confident and free I felt, markedly so. And I knew it was because of the experience with the dolphins. Then I gave another lecture a couple of days later back in San Francisco, and the same thing happened. There's this sense of freedom and ease in my own being that is unmistakable. That's the lasting effect. And I've noticed that not just here, other times when I've swum with dolphins. Mm-hmm. There's this sense which lasts, I would say, several days. It's really noticeable for several days. And then gradually, as always, the old world of stuff, and emails and busyness creeps back in. The people here, I mean, everybody is different. I mean, there's one guy, you saw him previously, he was just sobbing in the water, sobbing because it was such a moving experience just to be with them and witness them. And that, to just some people, just silenced, or the joy. Everybody is deeply, deeply affected, and that's almost the one thing you can guarantee, is everybody will be affected by the experience, and it will be different almost for everybody what happens to them. But something's touched deep down in your soul. That's the best way to summarize all of it, is something in your soul is touched.
I liken it to being in the presence of the master, or a master, a great avatar.
Yeah.
And not every dolphin perhaps is an avatar, but they certainly are masters of their environment. And there's a self-containment about them that being in their presence somehow rubs off.
Yeah, yeah.
And so maybe that's part of the experience. So many people do come to these seminars, and they have gone through different changes in their life, and many of them are faced with a dynamic transitional point right now. And the dolphins seem to be a great catalyst for these kinds of changes, perhaps for the same reasons that you're explaining right now, where a certain clarity, a certain sense of balanced being becomes part of the experience.
Yeah. I think also, coming back to what we were talking about earlier, it wakes us up from our dream, our hypnotic trance. Mm. We step out of that story we've been telling ourselves about what's important, or what's important, I'm going to do this on Mondays and do this and answer my emails and must see this and see this person and da 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 da, and suddenly here you are in a different world, in the water, with all that normal story which seems so important just pales. It's no longer important. I get back and I do the really urgent phone calls and emails, and the rest can wait. And in a way, if it doesn't happen, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. Well, this is a great liberating kind of an attitude to have. How can we, as individuals who don't have the luxury of living with dolphins or in proximity with dolphins, caught up in the everyday email rat race of the world, how can we, not including myself, but how can the normal person escape that and find these little pockets? What techniques besides meditation, or is that the key?
That's an important way of doing it. I think first thing is you've got to have some motivation to want to do that. You've got to, that's the first thing, is to realize you need to do that. You need to step out of it from time to time. You know, people say, oh, I can't stop, etc. Often they don't want to. They haven't, well, they want to, but they haven't consciously made that decision. So I think the first thing you have to do is say, I need to do this. This is important. I'm addicted to that old way. And just as, you know, with the 12-step program, they say, you know, you can't start, you know, whether it's alcohol or some other addiction, you can't start until you realize your life isn't working the way it is. Then you, when you come to the wall and you realize, I cannot go on like this. So I think, not the same way, you don't have to get desperate, but I think the first thing is the realization that there is more. I don't want to go on in this automatic way. And then just to set aside, I think two things. One, set aside time to just be with yourself. And that can be meditation. For some people it's just journaling, just writing. And I think what is often very useful there is writing your feelings. Because I think all of us get more caught in our head. Some of us very much so. I mean, I used to get so caught in my head. And just to journal, for me it was very important, what I was feeling, just to stop and do this for 10, 15 minutes, he said it twice a day. Didn't matter what it was, it wasn't to really sort out something, whatever it was, just to tune into yourself. And that's what meditation in a way is just being silent. And a very simple form of meditation, just being present to what is, just stopping, being aware of, you know, the sounds of the birds, the feelings in your body, whatever it is that's going on, just to stop and be present. So the first thing is just stopping.
Mm-hmm.
And the second thing is, and this again comes from the Buddhist teachings, is community. It's often called Sangha in Buddhism, of other people who are on the same path. In Buddhism, in the monastery, the Sangha is the group of monks who are there. But I think this can be taken out into our everyday world. And what I mean by the Sangha in that sense is your friends. And finding friends or identifying those friends you have who are also on a journey of awakening, who want also to not get so caught up in the world. And to be of support to each other. And that support can be encouragement, it can be reminders, it can be discussions of how hard it is to fit your practice in, it can be reading groups, it can be anything, meditation groups, anything at all. But the point about this is, I find we can't do it on our own. Well, it's much, much harder on our own. If we have feedback, learning from each other, we are a social species, we learn from each other the whole time. So in this area, you need to practice and learn from other people,
mm-hmm.
so that you can use that time you're putting aside to step out of things for its maximum value.
Hmm. Well, the way you've described what Joan refers to as the pod mind,
mm-hmm.
and one of the things that often occurs in a seminar when you're with a group of people that you've never met before, but you come to recognize that you're there for a common purpose. You've all signed up to swim with dolphins for one thing, and in that experience, there is a lot of self-caring, a lot of love being shared almost in a familiar way with one another, and suddenly you graduate out of the isolated separateness mm-hmm. that perhaps gave you this feeling to begin with. So what you're describing is pretty much what we try to replicate at any one of these seminars. You only have 5 or 7 days that you can come together, and I often tell people that, yes, we've come here for the dolphin experience, but what we've come away with is the human experience.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's so important. So the idea of sharing with others, and the other thing that occurred to me too was to turn off the television, turn off the radio.
Yes, yes.
That adds to the chatter.
It does. I mean, I can only think of one instance in my whole life where listening to the news was actually significant and of value.
Mm.
And that was stupid thing, but it's back in 1972 in the 73 when the oil crisis. I was in England and I had access to two vehicles at that stage. One was gas, one was diesel, and just by listening to the news I knew that I'd better take the diesel one out if I wanted to get any fuel. That's the only time listening to news has actually made any difference to my life. The rest of the time it's all part of the stitch. I've got to know what's going on. I've got to know what's happening, you know, mm-hmm. in government or out there, and I've got to know, I've got to follow this story. Isn't that awful or that's mm-hmm. exciting?
Mm-hmm. Well, we talked about addiction earlier on. It occurred to me, especially after 9/11, and this country with the way the media was treating that event and all the things around it, that we as a culture, at least in this country, particularly this country, has been pointed out by a couple of people, we have been weaned to become fear junkies. Every night at 6 o'clock or at 5 o'clock, we listen to the news to see what other terrible thing is out there that we might be afraid of, or there might be a new epidemic, there might be a new threat, a new terror. And so in doing so, I often wonder whether this has been a subplot, not conscious, like, you know, there's the conspiracy theories, but I think a subplot to the control mechanism in our society that goes back thousands of years. The sword being, you know, I will threaten you if you don't do what I say.
Mm-hmm.
So fear being the most motivating force that has been in our current society. And I have to say that that seems to be the most prevalent thing. Mm-hmm. How do we get rid of this addiction? In the same way, the 12-step program, we recognize that we are addicted to these objectives.
Danny, that's the first thing, is to recognize it. Well, it's interesting, if you go back to the 12-step program, as I understand it just from reading about it, the first step is to realize you are powerless over it, that you've tried, and you know, the classic thing is alcohol, but you know, you can't stop, it runs you, you're powerless, or you're powerless over television, the news, or whatever it is, or as just talking about the doing, the busyness of life, that it grabs you, we all become workaholics. The second step is an interesting one, again, it's what I was referring to, I hadn't realized when I was talking about just now, but the second step is you recognize you cannot do it alone, that you need help. You're powerless over alcohol, say, and you've tried it, you cannot do it alone, you need help.
Mm.
And the help then comes, well, in the 12-step program, the help is that's the third step, that you call upon a higher power for help. And there it's, you know, the God, however that is for you, whatever that word means for you, I would just say some higher power. Because I actually believe the higher power that we actually need to deal with our addictions comes from inside us. It's our own deeper self, that unconditioned consciousness. That's where our wisdom lies. And so for me, it's turning to that. It's that level of consciousness which lies there below the ego mind. It's very quiet, but it's there, almost waiting to be called upon. And so something I find a very useful sort of touchstone in my own life with any sort of addictive pattern like this, or addictive thinking. So much of our thinking is running upon certain addictive tracks, habits of thinking, is when I catch myself about to do something or thinking something, just to ask a very simple question, which is there another way of seeing this? Is there another way of seeing it? Not is there something else to do, or is there a way I can stop this, but to completely accept it, but just to ask, is there another way of seeing it? And what that does, it steps me out of the normal, the rut I'm in, and I'm asking that question basically to everything, you know, to the infinity of the universe, but it's really to myself, and just see what comes into my mind. And nearly always there's something which is so freeing. It's sometimes, if it involves another person, it's something which is much more compassionate, much more loving. If it just involves myself, it's more compassionate and loving towards myself. Often it's things which are absolutely obvious I never thought of. And I remember once, the first time it hit me was it was with the partner I was with at the time, who wasn't behaving the way I wanted him to behave, and I was getting frustrated and annoyed that they weren't doing what I wanted them to do. And it just struck me just to ask this question, and I just asked myself, is there another way of seeing this? And the answer just came booming into my mind, clear as anything. Here is just another spark of divinity struggling in her own way to get through in this crazy world. And it's like, of course, you know, nothing wrong with her. She's got her own stuff, I've got my stuff, she's struggling to do, to get through. And it's just like, it's, I just completely melted with compassion. And I could have gone on, you know, the addiction there was, I have to get her to be the way I want her to be.
Control.
Yeah, control. And that was my addictive pattern there. And just to ask that question, it's another way of seeing it, just came flowing straight out. And I find each time you ask that question, something different, it's different things, but whatever it is, I just hold that question, is there another way of perceiving this? And an important thing there is not to say, what is another way? Because as soon as you do that, you're getting slightly back into control. I want another way. What is another way? But just to be completely open, just say, is there? Because I find a lot of the times there isn't, or nothing comes. But if something comes half the time, then the half the times it does come, it's really useful.
And I notice now the philosophy, the Buddhic philosophy, that desirelessness equals liberation. So as, if you don't put it up as I need or want this as the ultimate outcome, then you're allowing the universe to come in and provide the solution to any problem.
And I'm not giving any direction at all. I'm just saying, is there another way of looking? I'm completely open. It's not, you know, I want a way to really understand this person better, because it may not be about that. It may be about understanding myself, or it may be about, who knows? It's just this completely open attitude.
Well, we are addicted to control as a society here in the West. And I went to Greece a couple of years ago on a quest to sort of, you know, figure out what was the root of much of our cultural problems. And it seemed to me that when we went back a couple of thousand years and we started something called laws, and everybody started to have to line up in a specific way and respond in a specific way, and then we came along with a whole thing called science that demonstrated how these laws were an effective way of organizing our lives and become what we would call a civil bunch of people, a civilization. And one by one are these ideas of liberation, the spontaneity, the connection with nature, the flow, ebb and flow of our natural being had been cordoned off and cordoned off and cordoned off. So now that several thousand years later, we've kind of painted ourselves in a corner.
Exactly, yeah.
So how do we go back? How do we unwind all of these 3,000 years of programming to get to the, to our own potential future?
I don't think we need to look at it in that way of unwind, because that makes it a really heavy, difficult, you know, almost like 3,000 years of programming. I think we can step out of it any moment of the day. And you know, that question I just gave, you know, is another way of seeing it, helped me many times just to step out of it in that moment and see things from a different perspective, from the perspective of that, that wisdom I carry rather than the ego mind. 10 minutes later, I'll be back in it. It's, so for me, but it is a conditioning, but it's one we can step out of. And so it's not about how do we get rid of all that past, but learning to step out of it. And I think stepping out of it is quite easy. Staying out of it is much more difficult, and that's where the skill comes in. But what we were also talking about before, coming back to the present, just coming back to the experience of what is. I mean, I find driving is a wonderful opportunity to do that. And, you know, you find people always saying, whatever you do, don't meditate when you're driving. You know, dangerous, of course it is. You've got to close your eyes and meditate when you're driving. I'm not suggesting anything like that. But for me, I started noticing when I'm driving, my mind is chattering away with the stuff of what I'm going to do when I get there, what happened yesterday, blah, 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 and I'll see something, I'll see a billboard, and it'll start me off, and I'll be thinking about this and that, and then complaining about politicians or whatever it is, and my mind is just doing its normal rubbishy chatter, most of which is totally useless. And I realized, when I'm driving, I don't need to be thinking. There's nothing I need to think about in the normal conceptual thinking. What I need is awareness of what is happening. If I'm thinking, if I'm distracted thinking about, you know, some crazy politician and what all, you know, the danger he's doing to the world, that's when I'm like to have an accident, because my mind is half distracted. I'm not noting, I'm caught up in the story I'm telling myself.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, when I'm driving, my practice is just to be aware. And as soon as I find my mind drifting off into some story, just coming back to being aware, both what is happening out there, the road, just being aware, but also I find sound, so a very good way to come back to the present. And I just, as I'm driving along, just to be aware, this, you find there's so many different sounds the engine's making, the wind is making against the thing, the tyres on the road. You get fascinated by how many sounds there are. And as I do that, I'm just in the present. I'm just with the experience of driving. And if something happens, I'm with it. I'm right there with it. If something happens in the road, I am conscious.
Mm.
So that's just, you know, that's where just coming back to the present. So I think it's, I'd say, not a question of how do we undo all that stuff, but how do we step out of the conditioning, step out of our thinking, whether it's, let's say, looking for another way of thinking, coming back to the present, taking time to meditate, physical, you know, activity. That's why, you know, many people just love swimming, running, that sort of thing. You get into your body again, getting out of your head. So it's finding many different ways to step out of that conditioning, knowing you're going to be back in it, because there's so many temptations coming from the world to continually remind us of stuff to think about. Plus, there's all our past experiences going to keep on churning up stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But it's that process of keep on coming back, keep on coming back, and gradually we get more skilled at it.
Mm.
Well, you've been called a futurist. That is to say, somebody who can take a kind of an accounting of where we are now and make a projection as to where we might be going. We've talked about more people, at least with the desire for self-awareness, finding practices to get in touch with being here now, and stepping out of the constraints of past and the worries of the future to be in the total present moment. Does it take a critical mass of people who are thinking this way to change the total? Is this the way that it works, and where do you see this is going with us in the next 10 or 12 years?
Everybody who makes predictions about the future is foolish, because they get caught out in the future. So many predictions have been made and turned out to be usually way under the mark.
Mm.
Most predictions about the future are way under the mark.
Mm.
I think there is this trend which is accelerating towards more and more people getting interested in the awakening of consciousness. And more and more of that is happening. I don't know whether it, you know, there's a critical mass which happens and everything changes. I don't know whether it's like that or not. What I do sense is a snowball effect. If you're rolling a snowball, the more you roll, the bigger it gets, the faster it rolls, the more snow it gathers, and it's an accelerating process. And it's just, once started, it just gets bigger and faster and faster. And I think it's the same thing with this. The more people there are who are working on themselves, who are beginning to wake up in some little way, the more that rubs off on the people around them, the more they gain the benefit of what's happening to other people, the more that inspires other people to do that work, the more books that are written on it, the more you see that stuff in, you know, television or movies, whatever. We're in this huge spinning positive feedback cycle in society, and whenever you get positive feedback, you get this acceleration. So I think it's going to keep on accelerating and becoming more and more obvious and visible, and that'll mean the progress we each experience in our own lives will also be accelerating. We'll find our own awakening is accelerating as a result of the fact that the sort of spiritual milieu in which we live is waking up and accelerating. Where that's going to take us in 10, 12 years' time, I think we're going to be in a world. Three things are going to be changed, all of which are on an accelerating curve. One is science and technology. That's accelerating at an unprecedented rate. I mean, in computers, the doubling time of computer chips about every 12 months. in 10 years time we'll be getting close to computers with the power of the human brain, which are going to design their own computers. But the technology of 12 years time, we can't imagine today. 12 years before today, people couldn't imagine the web as it is today. Stuff that we take for granted, like streaming a radio show. No one thought of streaming 6 years ago. 12 years ago, was the technology wasn't there, and here we are, we accept it as a day-to-day reality. We type in our URL and off we go, and you're listening to this. Mm-hmm. Who knows? Nobody knows, I don't think, where we're going to be in 12 years' time. Particularly, it won't just be the digital technologies, the biotechnologies will really be on screen then, the things that we can't even imagine now as possible, and probably even nanotechnology. And the second trend that's happening is the devastation that we're causing to the planet. That's also accelerating. Part of that because as our technology accelerates, the waste we put out accelerates, the way we consume accelerates, our hunger for raw materials is accelerating. And if we're talking about the new technologies, biotechnology, nanotechnology, who knows what can go wrong there as well, and the problems that might cause. It's a very, very, very dangerous when you start meddling with these things. So I think we're going to have technology that's magic compared to what we have today, powers that are beyond our imagination. We are going to be in a situation where the well-being of the planet and ourselves is far more precarious than it is today, and I think we're going to be with individuals who en masse are far wiser, more compassionate, more intelligent than we have today. How those three things work out, the most precarious situation with an incredible potential to do things and with the wisdom and compassion to make different decisions, we could find ourselves moving into a totally different way of being in the world. Or we might not. I don't know. But I just see we're heading in that direction. And it's absolutely fascinating and, to my mind, totally unpredictable. Totally unpredictable. I think, you know, if we were to gather in 10 years' time, we could gather whoever we wanted and say, let's look back to 2004, and I guarantee the one thing we would all agree on is none of us would have guessed how it was going to be. None of us would have guessed. That's going to be my only prediction. Is we will not know. It'll be unlike what we think in many, many different ways. And who knows what lies beyond that. I mean, I have this sense that the earth is our womb. Material womb. Consciousness is not bound to the material world, and I think we have enough evidence of that from things like outer body experiences, the sorts of things we were talking about before, psychic experiences, those sorts of things. Maybe, just maybe, what we're heading towards is the birth of our collective soul from its material womb. The earth has been here nurturing us, bringing us to this point, which we've never had before, of collective spiritual awakening. We've had individual awakening. They've been the great saints, the avatars, the gurus, the teachers, but they've just been little points of light. And the image I have is almost like, I think very visually, it's like there's this mass of dots, which are all the millions, the billions of dots of human minds. This cloud of dots, which is growing as the population grows. This cloud is getting more bigger and bigger and bigger. And at the same time, individual dots are just lighting up here and there. So as it grows, there's flashes of light, as individuals light up and then they die, another individual lights up. But more and more are lighting up. And we may be reaching this point where the whole cloud suddenly lights up and becomes its own being of light. Mm-hmm. And leaves behind its reliance upon space, time, and matter for its existence.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can certainly see evidence of that already. I described it as filaments of light, almost connecting like a web of luminosity that is kind of circumscribing the planet. And as it's doing so, we're beginning to see a planetary consciousness. And when we recognize that we are a planetary consciousness, then of course we can start to begin to see ourselves as a solar system in a galactic sense. Mm-hmm. And other people, many people believe that consciousness isn't limited to the physical world, as you've described, that there is something that goes beyond the physical, something that lives on a soul level, and perhaps something that can connect through the vast of time and space with other consciousness once we are able to let go of this addiction to the material reality.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all kind of an unfolding, beautiful lotus flower of unfolding.
Yeah, yeah.
Hmm. And here we are. We showed up for this, didn't we?
We did. I mean, I couldn't think of a better epoch in human history to be alive. I feel extremely privileged. I mean, extremely isn't even the right word. Just unfathomably privileged to be alive at this time in human history.
Mm-hmm.
And almost to, not only just at this time, but to be born when I was, the age I am, and to have basically arrived in time to see the whole of this awakening process, to be here after the Second World War, to live through what was happening, that beginning of it all in the 50s, that flowering that happened in the 60s, and then going off in search of the spiritual teachings, the gurus, and then gradually coming back to just this thing of people beginning to get it and wake up. There's an incredible process of awakening happening. And the thing that inspires me most is what's happening from one generation to another.
Mm-hmm.
That's, I think, where the change is really happening.
Mm-hmm.
That, I mean, I see kids today, I meet them because they're, you know, some of the work I do, or they're kids, of, you know, children of parents I know. Some of them, not all of them, but some of them have so much awareness, wisdom, understanding, compassion that didn't exist in the world when I was their age. It just really did not exist. And I, you know, I was deeply involved in the 60s movements, and we thought we were pretty hip, and I knew a lot of the key people there, and some people, you know, were pretty hip, but I think none of us had what some of these kids have today. And I think if you take some of these kids and put them back in a time machine, send them back to the 60s, people then wouldn't know what had hit them. They'd be like an ET almost, like there's some, these kids are so, like, why? Where did this come from?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we fully appreciate what has happened there, just that in the last 40 years, just two generations of many different things, more enlightened child rearing, but just a whole greater awareness that people are open to of what is happening in the world, that spiritual awakening that's going on, just not through the parents, being available to the kids. And what is interesting about this is one of these people, you know, I can meet someone who's, you know, 18 years old, who is awake as I am, just because I've been on this planet 40 years longer doesn't mean I'm 40 years more awake, more enlightened.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the bit that always gets me. It's society as a whole is 40 years more awake,
mm-hmm.
more enlightened.
Mm-hmm.
We all are. We're all moving through it together.
Mm-hmm.
And our physical age is irrelevant.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you've heard terms like the psychic children,
mm-hmm.
the indigo children, the crystal children to describe the phenomenon that you're describing. And I agree with you. I think much of our generation were put in a position to rear the next level of consciousness.
Mm.
And the kids are coming in, and they're influencing their peer groups, and their value systems are totally different than ours. We're also seeing some radical developments along those lines, because if these children are not given a way to vent their intelligence and their consciousness, they're finding oftentimes some very, very disturbing ways of venting it.
Mm.
And so a whole new level of child delinquency, you might say, that is coming about.
Mm.
Is this kind of a byproduct of the enlightenment of the culture, society, do you feel, that these kids are here at this time?
You mean people like the Indigo children,
mm-hmm,
etc.?
Mm-hmm.
I think so, yes. I mean, I don't know whether they're actually, whether there's something new coming in, or whether we are not overshadowing the incredible potential so much. I have a sense that people come into this world brilliant anyway. Babies come to this world with incredible brilliance in terms of light, shining, awareness, and we beat it out of them through
education,
child rearing, and just misapprehension of what a child needs. And I think we're allowing the light to stay there more.
Mm-hmm.
That, I think that's one of the things, that may not be the only thing, but one of the things I think is happening is we are allowing that light to be there and flourish.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're seeing that. So maybe what is there is just that innate clarity, wisdom that isn't being pushed down by, you know, putting kids on guilt trips and blackmailing, and this whole thing of depriving a child of love in order to make it behave better. It's so stupid and counterproductive, but you know, how many books have taught you how to manage your children, you know, train them
like little animals,
punish them, deprive them of love as a punishment, and they will soon get the message and do the right thing. I hear those horrible stories of, you know, people my age, of what happened to them in their childhood, out of well-meaning
mm-hmm.
parents,
mm-hmm.
didn't have, you know, all done with the best of intentions, and the wounds that has left on people.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, if we don't do that so much, the light is going to be shining through much, much brighter.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's dip into the paranormal here a little bit. We've pretty much covered what I think is a consensus reality, at least an enlightened view of consensus reality. But there's a lot of people who are out there who are experiencing things that are going beyond you know, some of these topics, such as the sense that they have been here before, the idea of out of body, but also out of life, coming in with an awareness of being in another lifetime or being in another presence. Some people even have likened the idea of time itself as shifting our awareness of time, and that we're letting go of this model, of the 3D model, as being the only relativity that is that we can function in. In other words, the past, present, and future are happening simultaneously, and so whatever we're consciously deciding now is actually affecting perhaps past life cycles and future life cycles. Do you have any opinion about that?
No, not really. I'm sorry.
Okay.
This is one of those areas that's just, it's interesting and it's all on hold for me.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, my attitude is just, you know, I get on with this life and strange things happen which I, you know, try to make sense of, but basically I feel it's about how do I live this life as with the greatest awareness I can bring to it, and work on freeing myself from my stuff, whether it's stuff that's come in from previous times or this time or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just personally my focus. Is I don't spend a lot of time thinking about it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, the reason I asked was I know that some of the exercises at the Monroe Institute, for example, will take people into a realm where they can start to commune with souls who have departed.
Yeah.
And that's a very real part of the Monroe Institute's work. And there are other people who are doing similar kinds of things because they feel that there have been a lot of disincarnated people who don't realize that they're even dead.
Yeah.
And they're kind of hanging around in the ethers or the astral plane, clogging up the system here like a pollution. Any opinion on that?
No, I don't. I mean, it's a fascinating idea, and I know people have very real experiences doing that sort of work. I haven't experienced it myself.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
mm-hmm. So the truth of all of that is, for yourself anyway, something that is non-experienced, so therefore you have to put it in a category of potential or possibility.
Yeah, it's on hold.
Mm-hmm.
And my jury is out. And that's the thing I say, you know, for me, I just, it's my own experience is important. When I experience something like that and it's a profound experience,
mm-hmm.
that's going to be something I will then spend more time really, really looking at. But
what would you term the most profound transcendental experience that you've had in this life cycle?
The most profound, I think, is just knowing, not knowing is the right word, being unconditional love. And that's come about in times of deep retreat practice when my mind has just silenced and I'm just, it's usually when there's some deep, really deep letting go, which is actually letting be in the end. Talk about letting go, it's really letting be. And I hesitate to use the word knowing because we think of knowing as an understanding or acceptance or all that stuff. It wasn't that. It's I am love, and all my I am just filled with love, and it's unconditional love because it isn't love that is focused on any condition. It isn't love for you or love for the world or love for, it isn't love for anything. It is just love. We all know the feeling of love, what love feels like. It is just to be totally enveloped, immersed in that feeling that one's soul is love. And to know that as a direct experience, that you just, that quality of love is there, and that, and then to interact in the world, to do things, to be with people, to eat your meal, to walk down the road, in that state of consciousness is the most profound thing. You still interact with the world, but you are love.
It's interesting. Unconditional love is one of the terms that we've used most frequently in describing the sensation of being with the dolphin. They seem to exude that aspect. And maybe as we spoke before, there seems like you're in the presence of the master. Somebody who is exuding unconditional love would certainly be, in my opinion, somebody who's mastered existence.
Yeah. I think they probably are. I mean, for me, that experience has come when I have let go totally of all this clutter, which I think ultimately comes from this thing of wanting to manage the material world and all the stuff we get caught up in. If dolphins have never got caught up in that trap in the first place, then I would say it's, by my book, highly likely that they are continually living in that state of unconditional love, but that is their, that is the water of their consciousness. As they float in the ocean, their consciousness is bathed in unconditional love, and that's where they operate from, and that's why we pick that up from them.
One of my earliest recollections of considering the idea of reincarnation was that if I could choose to come back as anything on this material plane here on physical earth, what would I be? And the dolphin became the most obvious thing. You know, looking at the life of a dolphin, somebody, an animal that's evolved so that they have these incredible facilities to detailly know their environment, all the food of abundance, a society which is usually caring and giving, with a few predators just to keep them alert, but basically a pretty carefree life. So most of their time is not concerned with any of the things that have become human, associations with survival or making a living or finding somebody to love or what to wear to dinner or where to live, all those things that we would consider material in nature, they've foregone. So they are great masters, and they have, I think, just by their mere presence, give us that clue as to what it's feeling like to be there. Maybe that's what brings people back. Maybe that's what brings you back.
I think so, yes. Something of that nature. Yeah, and often I guess if I were to be reincarnated, a dolphin would be pretty good. Though, I'd like to, humpback whale might be an interesting one too.
So, well, let's just sort of bring this together now. We've come full circle with the unconditional love as being one of the main elements that have brought us together here with the dolphins. And it's interesting that you felt that was probably the most profound experience that you've had, being able to experience that for within yourself. Would it be your intention to bring this kind of enlightenment to the people that listen to you, that read your books, that come to your meditations and seminars? Is that the one most important thing that you would like to impart to them?
I'd love to be able to impart it to them. I think to recognize that we, each of us, have deep inside us all that we are really looking for. The peace that we're looking for, that sense of ease, that sense of freedom that we're looking for, that experience of love that we are looking for, is all of that is our essential nature. That is the nature of consciousness. That pure consciousness, unadulterated consciousness, is at ease. It has this feeling of complete freedom. There is this love there. That is the essential nature of consciousness. And we don't know that most of the time because we are overshadowed by all these clouds of our thinking, our patterns, our worries, our feelings, our busyness, our doing, this tightness of the mind I talked about, which is the ego mind, all of that, and the fact that we are focused outside trying to find peace and freedom and love in the world around us. We're looking in the wrong direction and are getting ourselves totally uptight about it. We never see it, we never notice it. So it's what I'd like to impart is the value of seeing that, recognizing it, stopping, and finding whatever ways work for you as an individual to begin to free yourself from that clutter, the thinking, the quietening the mind, whatever works for you to quieten the mind, whatever works for you to come back to being in the present moment. And so beginning to taste a little of the essence of consciousness.
Well, to me, that's the theme of Dolphinville. And I really appreciate your being a guest of Dolphinville Radio. And hopefully you'll be back again and again to experience this wonderful atmosphere we all fondly call paradise of Lemurian ancestry. It's very important, the work you're doing, Peter. I really appreciate your sharing your time with us. I know that you're a busy fellow, and you must have some future projects, a new book or a new project on the works you were talking about, maybe soon.
I've got a screenplay I'm working on, which we'll see how it goes, but it's on the whole thing of awakening, spiritual awakening. And don't say too much about that at the moment, partly because things always change. And there's also the thing at less creative stage, not get the energy out too much. But people can always see what I'm doing, my latest writings, on my website, which is very simple, just peterussell.com or peterussell.com, just two L's on Russell is the only bit.
Okay.
And I've got some more books. I've got a book I want to write on letting go, which is sitting on the back burner. It's nearly ready for writing.
Mm-hmm.
But just that whole thing of, I think letting go is the ultimate message.
Mm-hmm. Fabulous. Well, thank you again, Peter. It's been a pleasure. And thanks again, Pete.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening, everybody. This is Dolphinus. Yeah, I appreciate your being here as part of the audience. And just a reminder, this program has been brought to you by Photon.net. They are an internet service provider that gives a whole range of services for you to indulge in. So check us out, Photon.net, and be sure to tell your friends to come and look at Dolphinville.com. It's a free membership. These archives of the radio shows are yours to listen to as a member. And I hope you can join us for the future shows coming up. Thank you so much for being here. This is Dolphinus, saying so long until next time. As the dolphins told to me, be well and swim free. See you next time.